Then we have to talk how, about how to organize, or what are the problems, and what are the organizations of European culture in the post-war world. And this is what must occupy us today. Now it is clear that the post-war world was very differentiated. That if you simply say that the problems of chaos and control, of rationalism and irrationalism, are endemic to the post-war world, so they were to the world before the war, already. But in the defeated nations, or those who thought themselves defeated, or still better, those who went through a cycle of revolutions, this idea of chaos and control, of rationalism and irrationalism, was obviously heightened, was more of a problem than to those countries that did not have a revolution after the war, and therefore did not have a counter-revolution, or at least an attempted counter-revolution. The division is clear from our point of view. It is between England and France on the one hand, and between Germany and Italy on the other. And this division between Germany and France, between Germany and Italy, and England and France, is now a division of great importance. But to that division, we must also count, for example, Hungary and Eastern Europe. That is to say, on the one hand, all those countries which had revolutions after attempted Bolshevik revolutions, and therefore counter-revolutions, and therefore a certain period of chaos, and a certain heightened conflict between rationalism and irrationality, and those who did not. But once we have said that, we must also be clear of the very great continuities. That is to say, that in all these countries, the spirit of 1914, this quest for rejuvenation, goes on. That in all those countries, the myth of the war spirit had a very definite impact. That in all of those countries, the problems of Marxism were posed. And yet, again, there is a difference. From 1918, the intellectual capital of Europe is Berlin, until 1933, not Paris. France becomes an intellectual backwater, and will in fact remain one until the end of the Second World War to a very large extent. But not Germany, it comes to the forefront, and to a certain extent Italy, but fascism came very soon to Italy in 1924, so there was not a great time for Italy to develop before fascism. But in Germany, there was. So that Germany comes to the forefront of culture, perhaps for several reasons. Because the cycle of revolution and counter-revolution and chaos was gravest there, in a Western nation. It's graver in Hungary, in some ways. But it was gravest there in important cultural Western nations. Because until 1923, there was a constant cycle of revolution and counter-revolution, and revolution and counter. That's one reason. The second reason is, and I've come back to that, the vicinity to Russia and the Russian Revolution. In Germany, the Russian Revolution had a much larger impact than in France or England. And thirdly, and that has something to do with it, which is difficult to explain, but nevertheless true, the cosmopolitanism of Germany and the increasing provinciality of France. Now, there is a problem here which you must be aware, because I would have said that in the 19th century, let's say after Hegel, after 1850, Germany was provincial, but not Paris. Paris was the center, together with Vienna, in a certain sense, where the center, Prague, were the centers, but Paris was the Mecca. And indeed, in the 19th century, if you like, apart from music and certain kinds of philosophy, indeed, France was the center, in many ways, of European culture. And Germany was provincial. For example, who knows German literature of the 19th century? Nobody knows the German literature of the 19th century. It is totally and completely provincial literature. It's a bit of special knowledge. But French literature of the 19th century, from Balzac to Zola, you all know, and at least you have heard about. But you would not have heard of Gustav Freytag or Wilhelm Heise or the equivalent Germans. You would never have heard of them at all. But after 1918, there is a rapid reversal. Now it is German culture that's in the center. And France becomes ever more provincial. Now, there are really no good explanation for this remarkable change, except the insecurity, except the cycle of revolution and counter-revolution, but also perhaps the fact that Germany had a break. It is now a republic. You shall see what that meant. That the struggle for rationalism did make it more open. That the France felt very much after the war that if they had won the war, they could really settle down into their provincialism. Now, it must be understood, without talking about national character, which is usually pretty much nonsense, it is still true that France has always been a deeply provincial country. That is to say, it has never really transcended its rural origins. That every Frenchman is really a peasant, no matter what he is, and if it isn't the little village, it's the little quartier in Paris. Neither in Berlin nor in Vienna, did the quartier, that is the part of the city where you live, play such a pronounced part as in Paris. In Paris, somebody is not really a citizen of Paris. He is a citizen of his quartier, the 16th or the 14th or the 4th. And in a sense, he is that, and his life is the quartier. In other words, you can say that France has never really transcended its rural origins. Webber just showed in a very important book. They never transcended its rural origins. Peasants into Frenchmen was always something pretty tentative. So that, even if you look at Paris and the industrialization, it is a series of villages. But there's more to that. What Stuart Hughes, in an important book called The Obstructed Path. French intellectual development was obstructed. But it was obstructed by provincialism, by a denial that anything outside France mattered, by a denial to learn any language outside France, French, a denial which was fine when France was the center, but a denial that became ever more dangerous in an ever more cosmopolitan age. The victory of the war made many French feel comfortable, made them settle in still more in their little provincial habit of mind. You can see that by the veterans' organizations. The French veterans' organizations supported the Third Republic. There was a general bourgeoisement among them, which you certainly don't find in disturbed Germany with its communist revolution, its rightist revolutions, so on. You find in front a certain settling in, a certain settling in, total, but a certain settling in, which perhaps strengthened the provincial mind, which has always been an imperial nation. Here I come to another factor I would not underestimate. Both in England and France, which are imperial nations, provincialism always had a better chance, because actually the English are just as provincial as the French. So that you have imperial nations who in a way had their self-esteem strengthened through the empire. The empire never sat on the British flag, and it barely sat on France. And there is an imperial nation something else, that the culture is a missionary culture. Now, Germany never had that. But France had it very strongly, and England had it very strongly. That our own culture is the best culture, and that we are carrying to the natives. As you know, French cultural imperialism is, in a sense, much more important than French real imperialism. And French cultural imperialism goes on to this day. For example, the French spent millions of francs on French schools in communist North Vietnam. It makes no difference. Wherever the French flag flew, the French spent millions on culture, because they believe, perhaps rightly, that politics is not as important. The North Vietnamese can be communists, but they still send their children to the lycée. That is true, by the way, of the communist leadership in North Vietnam. They send their children to the French lycée. So that there is a cultural imperialism. Now, how does that go into what I say? It makes these nations more provincial. They have, their culture is not only a culture, it is a missionary culture. And when you read in the culture of Western Europe that in the 1930s, that is still repeated by the Third Republic, Valéry and others still repeat that. France's civilizing function. That is the great phrase. And you have a similar phrase, after all, in England. England's civilizing function. But in Germany, the civilizing function had to be turned inward. There was no empire. So if German culture was to civilize, it had to civilize other Germans. Yeah. It had to make a connection with an inward nationalism. There were really no natives to civilize. Oh, I know there was German Southwest Africa, and there was Togoland, and there was New Guinea, and indeed, wherever the Germans were, and I have taught in the University of New Guinea, the German heritage is actually very strong. There are still the Prussian avenues with the same as in Prussia. There is still German, even as a basic language, in New Guinea today. And this is still very strong, because, again, the culture is strong, the Lutheran is strong. In New Guinea to this day, the only secondary education is Lutheran secondary education, and that tends to be German Lutheran secondary education. So what you have, you enter the bush, you suddenly find a hut, and in the hut there is a sign, Deutscher Club, German club. I felt at home. Anyhow. What you have, therefore, is, of course, the French discovered it first, the English then, that culture is perhaps the most important imperial factor, much more important. The others come and go, but culture stays, and it stays no matter what, because the Third World, of course, in a sense, is reaching for European culture, and the French got on to a good thing, and so did the British, of course, as well. Now, what you have, therefore, here is, these are tentative explanations for a very important fact then. Why, after 1918, Germany came to the center and France became a backwater, which it will remain for a long time. It goes in cycles. See, the cycle's difficult to say. I would say France becomes a backwater till 1945, and then I would say France again becomes a backwater maybe today, from 1917. On certainly Germany again goes to the forefront, and France again becomes. It's always the French provincial mind which prevents France from really making it permanently. And the English provincial mind would do similarly, I think, except for the accident that Americans read English. And therefore, Americans give to English literature a cosmopolitanism it does not really possess at all. So, but the French have no Americans to be the bridge towards a certain cosmopolitanism in their culture, so that the French, in a way, are imprisoned in iron cage. There's something else about it, too, that is important. After 1918, to a certain extent, the real problems for intellectuals are in Germany, not in France. For the real problems for intellectuals are problems of the extreme left and right. Marxism, or if you like, of the right, of the right-wing nationalism, and they are in some ways similar in their problems. Well, quiet countries like France and England didn't have these problems. And the result is that the Marxist Renaissance happened in Germany. And I think this is the thing that really, until Sartre in the 1950s, made France a terrific backwater. Because what is going to be important for intellectuals is the Marxist Renaissance. And from a Marxist point of view, France had absolutely nothing to offer, until Sartre. So what you have, therefore, here until the Sartre, after the Second World War. So what you really have is that the laboratory of Marxist thought is Germany. And it is Germany, not only because it had the most important socialist party, which it always had. It didn't have France's distracting anarchist and syndicalist traditions. So in Germany, the socialist party was always the big. There were no syndicalists and anarchists who distracted it from France. But it is also that after the war, with the attempted Soviet Republic in Germany, and the reaction, and it's Germany that comes from the center, and indeed, as some of you know, Lenin and Trotsky thought that Germany was the key to world revolution, that the world revolution must come in Germany, and they thought it would come in Germany. Because, of course, they were familiar with German Marxist thought, but, of course, not with French Marxist thought at all. So what I think is, to a certain extent, what gets Germany into the foreground is that it becomes the laboratory of Marxist thought, and that you have here a continuity, which I've already talked about, because I took you through the First World War. We shall come back to it in a minute. I took you through Lukács. I took you through Brecht. There is no French Brecht. There is no French Lukács. And of course, there is no English Brecht. There's no English Lukács, because England kept her empire. England was stable. And of course, England had never received Marxism in any kind of important manner. It never mattered in England at all. So that in England, there's nothing at all from this point of view. So I think that must be brought into consideration. If we look at another factor, it also becomes important. What we call culture, or what we have called culture here, is of course an urban phenomenon. And therefore, even when culture is concerned with peasants, it is urban people who write about it. It is urban people who are concerned with peasants, not peasants themselves. That is clear. And here, too, is a factor, I think, of some importance. If you look at these kind of cities, which were important as, if you like, the producing the kind of culture we have studied, above all, four cities in Europe, five cities produced that function, London, Paris, but still more important in a way, Vienna and Prague. Those four cities in the 19th century were all important. Now there is no German city. Why is there no German city? Because there is no united Germany. That is one reason why there was no German focus. There is no united Germany. Therefore Germany has no capital. You know that. That nations who became united very recently have no capital. There is no capital in Italy or Germany to this day. Culture is spread around many cities, not just one city, like Vienna in Austria, or in the Austrian Empire, or Prague in Czechoslovakia, in that part of the world. There is in Germany Hamburg and Munich and Düsseldorf and Köln. There is no London or Paris, not even a Vienna or Prague. Now this is important because it means that in France and in England and to a certain extent in Austria, Czechoslovakia, things were centralized. Culture was centralized. In Germany it is dispersed, which again makes it provincial, with the exception of course of philosophy, makes it again in a sense a provincial, even in provincial dialect. Many of the people you've studied, like Hegel or Schiller, didn't speak the German we speak now. They spoke Swabian dialect. So in Germany, much of the literature is dialectic, and the same is true in Italy. In Italy, most literature is dialectic, because there is no center. There is Neapolitan literature, and there's the literature of the Po Valley, and even the languages are different. So you have really, before 1918, when in Germany everything seems to be a pull to either Berlin or Munich, one would say the two, either Berlin or Munich, and almost entirely Berlin, you have none of this centralization idea. There comes something you should be aware of from there, that you cannot live in the provinces, except in countries which have been united late. In other words, you would never want to live in an English province, and you certainly wouldn't want to live in a French province, but you could live in the German or Italian provinces, because they're not provinces. That's right, they're not provinces. You could live in Florence, you could live in Naples, but you would never think of living in Lyon or Dijon or God knows where, and you would never think, I think, of living in Manchester and Birmingham or the city of Maynooth, York. They're terribly provincial persons. But you wouldn't say that Florence is provincial, or Naples is provincial, and you certainly wouldn't say Munich is provincial, or Hamburg is provincial. No, it makes a great difference, culturally speaking, to this day, whether a nation was unified early or late. You can guide your life by that. Now, what you have therefore here then are these cities. Now, there is a second thing about these cities and their culture producing. These cities will produce the culture best through conflict. Now, through conflict. Through conflict, above all, of different peoples, different customs, and different cultures. Now, in a sense, this was never true in Germany till 1918. But it was certainly true in Vienna, with the emigration from the Austrian Empire. And it was certainly true in Prague, where Czechs, Germans, and Jews all lived side by side in one city, all really with different cultures, except that you can say in the end, the German and Czech culture predominated. Indeed, Prague had German and Czech schools, German and Czech universities, and Vienna was similarly spread. This is, of course, not at all true of Paris. The result of this is, of course, a kind of intermixture which will lead to a certain kind of culture, in a sense a self-assertive culture. The culture of the right comes from Prague or Vienna for the most part. A certain self-exerted culture, but also a certain existentialist culture. After all, Kafka comes from Prague, yes? And you can say, by the way, the same thing in a limited way about Budapest, which is a German-Hungarian city. The culture of Eastern Europe was by and large a German culture. The Eastern Europeans reached for German culture and adopted German culture. Lukács is a typical example of that, somebody born in Hungary, or of German culture. They reached for German culture. But again, you can see that Budapest was a mixed city of German culture and Hungarian culture. But mostly, of course, of German culture, once again. So you can say, perhaps, that there was a certain German cultural imperialism in Eastern Europe. But it was a peculiar imperialism, that imperialism that carried German culture to Eastern Europe. It was entirely carried by the Jews, by the East European Jews. The East European Jews, as a tragedy eventually, were the great missionaries of German culture in Eastern Europe. They were the great missionaries. They brought it, like Lukács and others. They brought it, and then eventually it caught on in Eastern Europe. Now the point that I want to make is this, that to be sure, the more mixed the cities, in a sense, the more live the culture. The more live the culture. The more the bourgeois ideas were really challenged. Culture. The more, also, from our point of view, ideas of the left or the right became relevant to a clash of cultures. Now, in Berlin of the 1918, there was not much of a clash of cultures. But there's another class which can do the same thing, the economic class, the class of classes. Now this can have two effects, in Prague before the war, in Paris before the war, and in Vienna before the war. Culturally speaking, that mattered very little. Neither Freud in Vienna, who was terribly aware of the culture class, was hardly aware of the class conflict. And most of Jenny's literature was really not concerned with the class conflict. It was too new, if you like, and too much in the suburbs. So it had a lot to do with Luega and with the kind of anti-Semitism that went on. They just didn't see it as that. And the same in Paris. The class conflict was kept in Paris quite by policy outside the city as it is today. Today the working class are in suburbs, they are not in main Paris so much. Outside the city, similar. What I'm saying is that until 1918, the rich and the poor lived side by side. The middle class and the poor lived side by side without interpenetration, or without a great deal of interpenetration. And though the bourgeoisie was besieged, we studied that, in their own mind, there wasn't that interpenetration. They should have seen it, but they didn't. And so that you get the disturbances of culture of Kafka, of Freud, of all of these people who are extremely insecure, who were concerned with the besieged of the bourgeois society. That bourgeois society was under siege. Or those who wanted to bring it under siege, the expressionists, the futurists, all those we have studied, the class struggle hardly mattered. It only began to matter for the young socialists. And their great day came after 1918, not so much before. So, but what you have is had matter. But in the Berlin after 1918, you get something really new, I think, culturally speaking. And you get it through these young socialists. That the poor and the rich interpenetrate. And they interpenetrate through the discussions of Marxist thought. The revival of Marxist thought leads really to a new intellectual interpenetration of rich and poor. And I should say intellectual interpenetration of rich and poor. Now all these intellectuals are concerned with the class struggle of one sort or another, not a mechanical interpretation. As in the syndicalists or something. But a real intellectual interpenetration, which you don't have. For example, you know from old films on television, all these films that were made in America about New York, where the rich and poor live side by side. What are these kids called? What? Yeah, the dead end. If you look at their thing, the rich and poor live side by side, but they never interpenetrate. Intellectual. Now that is possible. That is possible. That's happened most of the time. But after 1918, Germany meets upon to the front because they interpenetrate. Not only, I suggest to you, on the left, but also on the right. It is obvious that the Nazis were as concerned with the working classes, obviously, as the communists. That is to say, on the left and right, there was an intellectual penetration, which I don't think happened in this regard in the other nations which were now cut off. After all, Viennese culture was brought to an end. What was Vienna now? A big head in a tiny body. A bloated capital without a country. What was Prague? It was becoming the subject of Czech nationalism and Czech provincialism. If you were in Prague in the 30s and spoke German on the street, you were attacked. So it was becoming a subject of Czech provincialism and Czech nationalism. There was no longer Prague culture. There was no longer Viennese culture. So that Berlin obviously moved to the front. If you see Kulawampe the other night, let me just say that in Kulawampe, you didn't quite see it, but the Berlin of Kulawampe is not disconnected. It is interpenetration. The Gorilla Theater at the end was probably written by a Jewish socialist intellectual like Toller, others, yeah? The Gorilla, or some kind of intellectual, In other words, what you have is an interpenetration. And of course, next week we're going to show you the most famous documentary about the Berlin of that time, Berlin Symphony of a Big City, yes? Where you will see more of this kind of thing, yeah? Of the Symphony of a Big City, again, made by intellectuals, again. For, as you will see now, as I come to the crux of it, out of the Berlin of the 19, out of the Germany of the 1920s, came this phenomena which we describe today as Weimar culture. It is largely but not always a Berlin phenomena, East Berlin dominated. And of course, this phenomena rests, is a thin layer on the populace in general. That is to say, when we now talk about the Russian, about the Weimar culture, the political theater, or anything like that, the new architect of the Bauhaus, when we talk about the new film, when we talk about all of this, this is a layer. The German people, as a people, went on with the usual popular culture, went on, of course, read the usual kind of things. It is a layer. But it is a layer, again, that eventually will become determinant, will become determinant. Because in a sense, our cultural patterns are taken from Weimar, our architecture is entirely taken from Weimar. And there are, after all, as you will see, definite continuities. Let me say one thing that I didn't tell you for French provincialism. For example, Freud never penetrated France. France resisted Freud to the end, really, till after the Second World War. There are reasons for that. One of the reasons is that French culture was always concerned with the mind, was always concerned with mentality. But it's also the Cartesian tradition. The French already had their tradition of what the mind was like. And they were not going to change it for this Viennese. So Freud and Jung and all psychoanalysis never penetrated France. That's a good example of how France became a backwater. Very good, because there was this added, not only Catholicism, because Austria is a Catholic country, where psychoanalysis originated a Catholic country, but it is again this narcissism, this with its own culture, and its culture studies, after all, mentality. Studies the Cartesian tradition, so you have it there again. Now, in reality, in Weimar culture, which must interest us, life not only went on, but in the end, the new lifestyles were co-opted. That is to say, in reality, bourgeois life went on. In reality, bourgeois capitalism was not falling, but quite strong. Appearances to the contrary. But in the end, because it was so strong, bourgeois life and capitalism co-opted what was new in Weimar. Otherwise, it would not have lasted if the new architecture and the new literature and even the new Marxist discussion hadn't been co-opted by bourgeois youth. Hadn't been co-opted, hadn't become a part, it would not, of course, have continued. It wouldn't have caught its recent audience. So then we can say that, with Stuart Hughes, that the French were ever more alone. The French were ever more alone. What then about bourgeois culture? In Weimar of the constant cycle of revolution and counter-revolution, and here again I must be clear that you've read it, I really leave it up to you to familiarize yourself with it. What about then of bourgeois culture? And it is typical for what I have said that the besieged liberals have to be cosmopolitan. That again gave to Weimar culture, oddly enough, from the liberal side, a kind of cosmopolitan, though a very tragic kind of cosmopolitan gloss. What do I mean by that? The liberals, of course, in Germany were caught between the left and right, the between the Spartacist Revolution, the Kapp Putsch, the Bolshevik Revolution of 1923 in Saxony, the counter-revolution. Back and forth, they were caught, and then eventually the Depression, so on. They were caught. And with them, the first problem is raised, that the Weimar Republic raises in a heightened manner, the problem of rationalism and irrational. And that is, of course, related to the problem of keeping control. The problem as the German liberals saw it, the Jenny Tribals of the day, if you like, or the daughters of Jenny Tribal, because that would be the generation. The way the sons and daughters of Jenny Tribal saw it, there were now two problems. One was to strengthen rationalism against revolution and counter-revolution. And the other was to keep control in a situation which was always on the brink of escaping from control. The mobs, like in Iran today. I guess an Iranian liberal has the same problem. So you have this kind of problem, control. Now, how were they going to solve it? And the answer is that they had no German tradition to look back to, which seemed at that moment for them to be strong enough. So they tried to solve it, and this is very typical and important, they tried to solve it by looking to France. And out of this confrontation with France, trying to solve it with France, come some famous confrontations. Confrontations between liberals and nationalists. Above all, between liberals and nationalists, and also eventually confrontations between liberals and socialists. The man who more than other can be a symbol for this, looking to France, is Thomas Mann's brother, Heinrich Mann. And what is more typical for that confrontation is the famous confrontation of Heinrich Mann with his brother in the First World War. Now, Heinrich Mann believed, and I quote, in a dictatorship of reason. He wanted to revive the 18th century in order to strengthen the liberalism of Germany. The result of this was that during the First World War already, he wrote essays on Zola, on the French tradition, and began to uphold France, something that his brother Thomas attacked in a very famous essay, Confession of an Unpolitical Man, and attacked it for ignoring Germany, for ignoring the romantic impulse, for being, in other words, immaterial. And the 18th century tradition from the left will be accused, from the right, will be accused of being a materialist tradition, of ignoring romanticism and the soul. But it is typically also that eventually Heinrich Mann was rejected by the left. He tried when the Nazis came in to make a united front between liberals and left, but eventually his hatred of the left, who he thought had given up reason as well, namely ideas of parliamentary government and liberalism, the ideas of the Weimar Republic, made him fail for a united front after 1933. His most famous novels, by the way, are also about peace and tolerance. His most famous cycle is about the French King Henry IV. Of whom you may remember that he deemed the peace of France well worth a mass. He became a Catholic in order to make peace in France after civil war. He advocated tolerance, and if he didn't quite advocate parliamentary government, Heinrich Mann makes him come very close to that. So Heinrich Mann's great cycle of novels is the cycle of Henry IV, though early on he had written something you've seen, The Black Angel, Professor Unrat, as a criticism of German nationalism, a criticism of anti-liberalism. That is Professor Unrad is, the fossilized structure of Imperial Germany. So he had made his mark as a social critic, was criticizing Professor Garbage, the Black Angel, by showing how the present imperial system, remember, destroys the individual. He was enthusiastic for the Weimar Republic, because that again seemed to reestablish the individual on the basis of representative government, on the basis of tolerance, and above all on the basis of race. In the Black Angel, Professor Unrat becomes a clown in the end. He loses all reason. He loses all contact with reality. He becomes a clown in the end. So that reason must be strengthened. And so, not only in Heinrich Mann's mind, but in the mind of all of these liberals, reason and the Weimar Republic go together. And therefore, France. Because they looked not at the nationalist France. They looked at the France which had coped with the Dreyfus Affair. The France which had won the Dreyfus Affair, won tolerance, had reestablished Dreyfus. The France of the Third Republic, the France of the Enlightenment. That is the France they looked to, not the France of the Action Française. That is the France they looked to. Now the tragedy is that these ideas were taken up also in politics. Above all by the democratic press, by the big newspapers, which were in the Tageblatt, the Frankfurter Zeitung, the great prestigious Weimar newspapers, and their equally prestigious editors. But also the Democratic Party, which was at first a large party and of course became smaller as time went on. And even the Social Democratic Party, with which Heinrich Mann has sympathized, even they took up this idea and called for a dictatorship of reason. Those who managed the Democratic Party wanted to transform it into the French Radical Socialist Party. The model was always France. France was the star. And therefore you have a kind of irony that at a time when Paris became the backwater, it became the star on the horizon for German liberals, though Germany was really the experimenter of the new. Too much. They wanted to hold on. They wanted long order in the Weimar Republic. So they looked to the Enlightenment. They looked to all of this. They looked, in fact, to Paris as still the great lodestars in their lives. And their life became more and more isolated. But what German would really look to France, the nation that just defeated it? It's kind of crazy. It's kind of crazy, but it's still true. The nation that defeated it. Who would look to France? So it made, in fact, for a very great kind of isolation. Isolation. A way of complete control. A way of strengthening reason. And a way of trying to import French culture into Germany. But this, of course, ignored the real ideas of Weimar, the real streams of Weimar, which were not at all streams towards reason, but irrationality, which were streams that combined the both, and streams that had to do, above all, with collectivity. And I'll go on with the new environment, the architecture, and things.